Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Delta Flyers Journey Through the Wormhole with Quark, Dax, and their good friends Tom and Harry. Join us as we make our way through episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yes, indeed. And for the complete and exciting version of this podcast, check out patreon.com/thedeltaflyers and sign up to become a patron today.
Your hosts for today are my fellow Trek actors, Terry Farrell, Robert Duncan McNeil, myself, Garrett Wong, and our special guest and now my favorite Deep Space Nine writer, Robert Hewitt Wolf.
Robert, welcome back.
Thanks.
You're a gem to do this, and your memories and your thoughts on all of it are amazing.
Honestly, you're a really fun guest.
Yes. You are.
It's just fun to hang out with you. I've never spent this much time with you, so this is really nice.
It's crazy.
And to further your point, Terry, I think Robert flowed so well with the three of us, you know, and the last time we recorded with him.
Absolutely.
It was effortless. So that's something that we love to have happen. And my first question for Robert is, please tell us what is behind you on your wall. That looks like a mobile of some type of something's going on.
There's that's a fish mobile. So they're like little painted tropical fish.
Yes.
Behind that is every year the construction department at Deep Space Nine used to give these little plaques that had set designs on them. So that's Ops, and then that's the Defiant. You can't really see that.
Yeah.
That is my Leo Award for Best Series for Andromeda.
Nomination.
That's amazing.
That's all right.
Golf clap.
I don't have any awards.
Yeah,
I'm impressed.
Only a nomination.
Yeah.
And then that is a crossbow that the Rade tribe of Central Vietnam gave to my father when he was a Green Beret, and he was their military advisor. He was the leader of an A team, and he deployed in, I think, 1965 to the highlands of Vietnam, where he was the lead military advisor to a tribe of people, indigenous people from Central Vietnam called the Rade. So he had 1,000 Rade riflemen that were under his command.
Okay, good. So that's the Rade amazing. Had rifles, not the bows. Okay,
the crossbows.
So the crossbows, you know, were certainly something that they made, but we gave them rifles. So,
Because when you showed me the bow, my first thought was I was thinking about going to the Star Wars universe, Ewoks. You know how Ewoks, they seem pretty not cute. Really lethal when you see them. They've got bows and arrows.
Looking.
Yeah, they're cute. Yeah, they're teddy bears. So I was wondering if the Rade were also Ewok-like, but no, they got rifles. So that's good.
They had rifles. And don't forget that the Ewoks ate stormtroopers by the end of the movie. So.
That's true.
They had the helmets there. I forgot about that. Okay. How many of you listeners and viewers would have thought that we would be talking about Star Wars on the Star Trek podcast?
Us started, or we will talk about Star Wars the whole time.
Oh boy.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Robert, I have a question for you. It sounds very dramatic what your father did for a living, you know, his job. Do you ever use any of the stories or the experiences of that in your writing? Have you ever kind of?
All the time.
Oh, wow.
All the time. You guys have already done The Wire, so.
Oh, that was about your father then.
My father liked to tell stories. Many of them weren't true. He was a closeted queer man.
I do the same thing.
And so, there's a lot of Garrick. My dad, there's a lot of Garrick. My dad ain't Garrick. Wow. A lot of my dad and Cisco. The sort of like different aspects, obviously.
Yeah.
But the sort of like my dad was a base commander. My dad was a professional military man.
Yeah.
He was decorated, you know, like real deal. He had multiple bronze stars and air medals.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. That would be a really rich well to draw on, especially in the Star Trek world, you know, Starfleet and the military and those stories. So that's very cool. Very cool.
Well, I have a follow-up question. What about your mother? Do you draw upon experiences 100%. Of your mother for your writing?
My mother was an RN. And ER nurse was very, very dedicated to her job. She died very young, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Cancer.
That's too bad.
But so a lot of the, like, you know, little bits of Kira, little bits of Dax, little bits of Bashir, you know, are also drawn from my mother.
Wow. Very cool.
It's just, you know, I think that that's the easiest thing for most writers is to pull little bits of their family. All that stuff.
That's very cool. Very cool to hear that.
My mom was very, was a little bit of a trickster, roguish type person. She told stories about when she was a terror in nursing school. So some of that got into Dax for sure. My mother once, there was a bat that flew into their nursing school. She went to this Catholic nursing school. This bat came in and somehow it was like, it hit something or was stunned or it was like, so she caught the bat.
Wow.
And then she put it in the head nurse instructor nun's desk drawer.
Oh, God.
Mom.
Wow. Very
love
clever.
Love your mom.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
What a trickster. Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
So very cool.
She caught the bat with like a garbage
can, right?
That
part of
not
the story
her
I'm very
hands.
Unclear on. I'm very unclear on how she caught the bat. And
all right.
P.S. Don't try this at home.
Yeah, please don't try catching
the bats. Please don't mess with bats.
No.
But somehow she managed to capture the bat and then put the bat into the drawer of the head of the school.
Wow. She is a trickster.
I have the first birthday, Sean T, February 2nd. Happy birthday, Sean.
Happy birthday, Sean.
Happy birthday, Sean.
Happy birthday, Sean.
Next up, we have Karen Galeski. Happy birthday to Karen on February 5th.
Happy birthday, Karen.
Happy birthday, Karen.
Happy birthday, Karen. And our last birthday this time is for E. LaRoque on February 7th. Happy birthday, E.
Happy birthday, E.
Happy birthday, E.
Happy birthday, dear E. Happy birthday to you.
And many more.
For Past Tense, Part 2, your limerick.
In the sanctuary, the homeless are starting a coup. How they get out of this pickle, I haven't a clue. Sanctuary problems are revealed and the timeline is healed. But for us, there's still work to do.
I think that's great.
I do like this whole this issue of homelessness, and I wanted to make sure I got that in there. You know,
agreed.
This is still something we got to work on.
Agreed, Terry. Well, what do you have for
what
us?
What do you got?
Oh my gosh! Yeah. Now I'm super nervous. The ticking time bomb to lose our freedom is real. That doesn't diminish our focus on our deal to keep the timeline in our sight. We fight with all our might. Justice and freedom is our prize. The future of the Federation is no small guise.
Oh,
there you go.
Very nice. Yeah.
Well, guys was the only thing I could think of that rhymed.
It worked. Guys. It worked.
G-U-I-S-E, like that, guys.
Yeah. Yes. And believe me, at 5 o'clock this morning, I was like, how do you spell that? I can't believe I can't think of how to spell it. And I spelled it right. And I was thinking, the heck can't be right. I don't know what funny. The heck.
Sometimes you look at a word, you're like, that's no, there's no way. That's not right.
Right?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hear you.
I have a song. Song
you have a song.
You have a song?
What?
I'm just, you know.
I love how creative this is.
It's awesome.
Robert, amazing.
Under Pressure, song by David Bowie and Queen. Pressure pushing down on me, pressing down on you. No man asks for under pressure that brings a building down. Splits a family in two, puts people on streets. That's the terror of knowing what this world is about. Watching some good friends scream, let me out. Pray tomorrow gets me higher. Pressure on people, people on streets.
Wow.
Yeah. People I was kind on of expecting streets. You to sing it.
No. No one wants that.
That was so perfect. Now, did you have
great
that
song
in
idea.
Your head when you were writing it? I mean, is that something that came back to you?
I feel like it's certainly, you know, just like the you know, it just shows that it's a problem that's the song from 1981. It's a problem that's been around for a long, long time. And, you know, it's just, it was probably partially in my head when I was writing it. I tend to write with music. It's a lot easier now because of streaming, you know.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I tend to think about music a lot when I'm writing. Yeah. For rhythm and just like feeling and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, that's so cool.
And sadly, it's a timeless song.
Sadly.
Yeah. And what are musical lyrics other than poetry, pretty much, in a way, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I love
good
that
ones.
You use that.
Anyway.
Yeah. The good ones,
I like it when they used to have all the lyrics on the back of the album.
The album.
In the inside.
We're all showing our age.
Oh,
so great. When they're on the sleeve, when you pull it out.
Yes, wasn't it great? Oh, or if I it came it. In a booklet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. All right, here's my haiku. For past tense, part two. Cisco runs the show. Sanctuary in chaos. A timeline restored. That's it. Thank you.
Nice.
Very good.
Very nice.
The haiku always seems to just wrap it up so succinctly. I like it.
It does. It really does. Okay. So, teleplay by Ira Stephen Bear and Renee Echevarria. Story by Ira Stephen Bear and Robert Hewitt Wolf.
Woohoo!
So this time you contributed the story, but there's no teleplay writing on this.
We just divvied it up. I mean, we all three of us kind of helped each other on both parts.
Yeah,
but I think I got sole teleplay credit on the first part.
Right.
And Ira and Renee split up the teleplay credit
for part two. Okay.
Can I ask you something? You get a contract to work a certain amount of time with a show.
Yes. Yeah.
And then do you get bumps for story, bumps for writing?
Yes.
Like kind of like football player making a touchdown, they get a bump?
Basically, like...
I thought that was
so
a nice
we get
analogy.
A weekly pay or an episodic pay. It depends. On this season, I was an executive story editor, so I wasn't a producer. So everybody up until executive story editor gets paid a weekly contract, but it's guaranteed for a certain number of weeks.
Right.
And then every time you write a... teleplay or story or anything like that, there's a guild mandated payment on that, and our residuals are based on the stories and teleplays that we write, not on actors get paid
staff.
Every episode essentially that they appear in, we only get paid residuals. Actors get paid for every episode they appear in. Writers get paid and directors get paid only for the episodes where they either write or direct.
Yeah.
And so, you know, about actors, Deep Space Nine was great about making sure that we got in every episode. And sometimes it was just voiceover, but we still got residuals for those. And that was
That's
a really
great.
Amazing thing that the production did for us.
Yeah.
We tried really hard. In this one, Quark is not in the episode at all. And that's rare, but there was just no way to get him in as much.
Yeah.
As
you got him in that phone call, the video.
We got
call,
him in the first one.
Episode. Yeah,
when we wrote that scene specifically so that
for his residuals,
residuals. So we often would have you'd see that there's a bunch of episodes. Sometimes we're like, oh, there's you know Terry to come in for her one line for this episode. So paid.
Yeah, sometimes when I'm not even there, but then you have ADR, and I'm like, why do I have ADR? I was never even in the episode.
Right.
It's like for a calm thing.
Yeah, if you want the residual, go to the ADR. Exactly.
Yeah, like every production, there's ups and downs and good and bad people, but we did a lot right on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Not everything, but we tried.
Yeah, I think you did a good job.
Mm-hmm. Well, this episode is directed by Jonathan Frakes. This is his third and final directing gig with Deep Space Nine, but it was his direction of this episode which secured him the gig to direct Star Trek First Contact, the feature.
Wow.
So that helped him a lot, for sure. Guest stars, Jim Metzler as Chris Brenner, Frank Military as BC, Dick Miller as Vin, Deborah Van Valkenburg as Preston, Al Rodrigo as Bernardo Calvera, Clint Howard as Grady, Richard Lee Jackson as Danny Webb, Tina Lifford as Lee, and Bill Smitrovich as Webb. My goodness, okay. Clint Howard. Who got Clint to come in on this? Was that, whose job was that?
He auditioned.
Did he really?
I swear to God, he auditioned.
Wow. Okay.
And I was in the auditions, even though I didn't do the teleplay. For some reason, I was in the auditions.
Yeah.
Clint Howard is auditioning. Of course, we're going to give him the job. You
know? Of course. I mean, he was in the original series, right? So
exactly.
Yes.
So
Yeah. But I did read in on Memory Alpha that it was initially Iggy Pop's job, but Iggy Pop was not available to
that
film.
That sounds right.
Get
yes.
out.
Yes.
Well, we got him eventually.
You got him eventually in season six, is
so
what it
amazing.
Says. Yes.
I was trying to get Iggy Pop on the show forever. And it was just a scheduling issue. Because like it was something that Iggy Pop wanted to do, apparently.
Yeah.
But, wow.
But it was a scheduling problem. I mean, we had that there were a few people we chased for years and either got or never got. And Iggy Pop was definitely one of them.
Can you name the other two?
We really wanted to get Sid's uncle on, Malcolm McDowell, and we couldn't. So we tried and it was just, you know, we could never quite make it work.
Anyone else besides Malcolm?
That was the big one. That was the big forever. One.
Yeah.
But there was at least one or two others that we looked for forever to try to get. I mean, obviously, like originally we wanted Frank Sinatra Jr. to play
Vic
Fontaine.
And
we
there was some engagement, and we chased after that for a little bit, and then we could never make it work.
Doing that scene with Clint Howard, I was so excited because I was such a big fan. And it was so much fun to watch back again. It was just tickled. It was so sweet. He was so sweet.
He's so sweet.
Super nice guy, huh?
Yeah.
Did his brother come visit on the set that day? Did Ron Howard show up?
No.
Yes or no? Oh, that would have been so cool,
fun.
Ron Howard.
But when I turned 21, my birthday was at the China Club.
Yes.
I was dating Mickey Rourke.
Yeah.
David Bowie was one of the guests at my birthday party. And made sure that it was Ron Wood, Stephen Winwood, Iggy Pop, and David Bowie sang me Happy Birthday.
Oh my God. Look at you. Oh.
And I remained friends with David Bowie for a long, long time.
Oh, I'm awesome. Such a huge David Bowie
so
fan.
So crazy.
I love David Bowie.
This business, right?
That would have been amazing to get David Bowie on DS9.
I think we actually did chase David Bowie for something too for a little while.
Did you? You should have called Terry.
I wish I would have known. Yeah. I would have begged him.
A lot of people like that are scheduling. It's impossible. Yeah. It's just impossible. They're way, way too busy.
They're on tour.
But like we
also, or they're in Europe.
Yeah. When Bashir and O'Brien sing Jerusalem in whatever episode that is. I can't remember now.
Oh, when O'Brien gets really sick.
Yeah. Is it, like
he's in Jerusalem.
No,
you guys remember?
The one where he goes through the aging thing. Is that the one? I can't remember if it's Hard Time. Anyway, I don't remember if it's Hard Time or not, but when they sing Jerusalem, we originally were going to have them sing Space Oddity.
No.
Oh,
and we couldn't. It was too expensive. And then we went after Rocket Man, also too expensive.
Yeah.
We went after Life on Mars, also too expensive. We're finally just like, all right, what's public domain that you guys can sing? And I think Jerusalem was Calm's idea. Anyway.
Wow.
Super cool.
Let's jump into it. Yeah. Part two starts out in the processing center. We are inside with the hostages. We hear sirens. We hear helicopters. And BC gets a little rough in this opening scene. He's getting rough with the hostages. Vin comes in and Sisko disarms him immediately. Mm-hmm. And basically, Sisko and Bashir are trying to keep everything calm and safe in the scene. BC wants to see the news feed. And Bernardo gives him access, his access card in the scene.
But that was like a scary moment there.
Yeah.
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 Because Vin didn't want to give it. And it was like, oh, if he shoots Vin, this whole thing's going to blow up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the tension for me is writing, is it Vin's character? Yeah. Writing Vin's character to be the one that's just so cavalier about saying whatever he wants to BC, who's got the shotgun. And it just the whole time I'm like, don't stop talking, please. You're going to get shot. But
stop being Dick Miller.
Yeah, stop being Dick Miller.
We know you do it well, effortlessly. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Bashir and Sisko do have a conversation in the scene where Bashir's kind of worried that if Gabriel Bell dies, it's going to change history. And they're the only ones that know Sisko is not Gabriel Bell. So they kind of reset a little bit, you know, the stakes in this scene.
Yeah, I was so happy for that little moment between the two of them to take us back to our perspective of what's happening
yeah.
And what our goal is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't talk about Bill being shot by BC at all in this second parter. And it was on purpose, according to the, you know, what the writers were saying. They wanted, they didn't want everyone thinking about, oh, Bashir and Sisko are trapped in a room with a killer, with a murderer, a cold-blooded murderer. So it was all about, we want to not have that in there. We want to basically, you know, not focus on that theme. So there was definitely some pre-designed manipulations of that script to make sure you didn't hear that.
Yeah, I don't remember that specifically, but I do know that we wanted to sort of like mess with people's sympathies for BC.
Yeah.
And sort of take them on a little bit of a journey with the guy. So that's probably why we avoided reminding people that he stabbed Bell.
Yeah. It said
fatally in the stomach, by the way. Yeah. Where
I know.
I don't know how that happened, but okay.
Here's a quote from Ira. Bear wanted to use the character of BC to illustrate the notion that if you treat people like animals, they become animals. If BC had not been homeless, what would he have been? We created his backstory stuff that would never appear on the screen and decided he probably would have been a garage mechanic or something, even though he's obviously a threatening, scary character and he's on the edge crazy all through both shows. We didn't define him as a murderer. That's the quote from Ira.
Yeah. So. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great.
Well, we come back from the opening credits. They're watching the news report. You see riots, you see fires. Things are really blowing up. And then Webb shows up and Sisko says to let Webb in, that he's a friend. And Sisko has a little aside where with Webb, where he says he needs to he needs him to gather more gimmies, bring more gimmies over here to help guard the hostages because the ghosts are trouble. Ghosts will make a mess of everything. So Webb goes to find some of his buddies, some of the guys next door, how he describes himself later on.
And he looked like that. It was perfect casting. Perfect.
Yeah, it was nice. So things are starting to develop. Sisko's trying to figure out a plan here. We go to Chris's office, where Dax and Chris are also watching the news. And Dax really wants to go find her friends. And Chris is like, no, it's too dangerous. You know, you can see these riots on the TV, on the news feed. But Dax insists. She's like, none of these people, my friends don't belong there. And none of these people belong there. We start to learn her perspective as well, like where her head's at. She gets that this is not fair.
And I can't explain to him what a badass I am.
Yes, exactly.
And how capable I am. Yeah, and then I could probably take him out. Exactly.
What a badass. Action hero. I'll be fine.
Do you know who you're talking to?
He has no idea.
No idea.
That's funny.
You know what's also interesting? That prior scene when they're trying to get that authorization card to get on the net. This is sort of the beginning of the internet at this time, isn't it? When it's in this
barely.
When people were kind of
it was in its early days for sure. I mean, there were bulletin boards and people had email.
I had the dial up.
It was maybe AOL.
Yeah,
you know, but like there weren't a lot
begging
of web
people.
Yeah.
Please. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of web presence, but it was like, give me your email. I want to use my computer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much shopping.
Right.
There wasn't real shopping on it, was
it? No.
And there definitely was no streaming video. There was no, none of that. Right.
No.
So
no.
It was very early days.
Yes. But the concept that the sanctuary has no access to the internet whatsoever is just so foreign to us now. Like we're all so used to getting on to the internet.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
like
there was no Wi-Fi back then, right?
That's cool. Okay.
Yes.
It was all wired. You had to get on the internet. You had to plug a phone line into your computer.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And dial it up and it would
make
those noises that people sometimes hear still in like
can
old
still
TV
hear
photos.
It in your head, can't you?
Yeah.
so we didn't understand, like what we didn't anticipate obviously was the ubiquity of cell phones,
right
and their ability to just be like a giant, like what back their way any cell phone now is 1,000 times more powerful and versatile than any computer was back when we were writing this.
Any computer, not any phone, you're talking about computer. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly, like an actual desktop. There were no laptops. That was desktop.
No. Desktops. Yeah.
You know, and they were giant and bulky, and they had like TV size, old fashioned TV screens.
Yeah,
that were
the CRT.
Really expensive.
Foot thick. They were very expensive. Yes. It was a whole thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so we obviously had no idea how that was all going to evolve.
Yeah.
And cell phones were super expensive. I mean, just to use them were expensive.
They existed, but like, I didn't know anyone that had them. As writers, Ira had to carry a pager. They would page Ira if they wanted to change a line at like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh God.
And he would have to, and then he would call in.
Yeah.
Wow.
To a landline.
Right.
Yeah.
To talk to the script supervisor to approve the line change.
Oh God.
The next scene is a space shot. We've got a first officer's log supplemental. Kira says somehow Sisko, Dax, and Bashir have altered Earth's history. We have no choice but to send an away team into the past to try to find them and to correct the changes to the timeline. The only problem is we're not exactly sure where to look or when. So they sort of reset the stakes of on the Defiant of what's going on there, that, you know, the timeline has been changed, that Starfleet never existed. And then we go inside the transporter room and O'Brien's kind of telling Odo about this tech solution, you know, basically recapping for us as well. O'Brien is telling Odo that he thinks he knows how to do this, that he's narrowed it down to 10 possible timelines.
Yeah.
So now from all the time in that's ever existed, we think it's only 10 possibilities. Mm-hmm. And then Kira enters the scene with her nose bandage, which I loved.
That was so cute.
She does not like it at all. But my first thought was, oh, they just put the nose bandage on, so she probably didn't have to sit in a chair and get the prosthetic on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was wearing the bandage. So, yeah, that was an upside for her.
I understand hiding Vulcan ears, but you don't need it. I don't think anybody really would have said anything about that to her. I'm sorry.
How do you know? That would have looked so weird in any time. Yeah. It would have been startling. I think people would have noticed right away.
I also just liked her attitude. It was funny, the comic relief of her, like, I hate this.
Yeah, and, but if they didn't do it, Gawa, if they didn't do it, it would be like, oh my God, why didn't they cover her nose?
You're right.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, you're right.
We would be jumping on it.
You're right.
So. Yeah, 100%.
Okay, they covered it. They covered it.
It was a little bit of an homage to City at the Edge of Forever, too, where Spock wears the watch cap and pulls it down over
his
ears.
Yes.
Exactly.
We love that stuff.
They energize. I thought Renee did a very nice job with one finger of sliding up the panel.
A single finger energized.
It was kind of funny.
They beam out, though, and we see like the shot is over. You can tell it's a period car.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You can immediately, you know, they're in
like
the wrong
the 20s.
Timeline. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They're back in the 20s or 30s.
30s. Yeah.
And, oh, wait. Isn't it cute? Okay, that when they say, I don't know what happened with the couple, and she just said, I broke my nose, and she turned, and it was so cute.
Like she was
it was like she was a little girl. It was so sweet. We never see Kara like that.
Yeah, you don't. You don't. There's a little innocence there. It was kind
like
of
a little shy or something.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you notice the boxing advertisement? Did you guys notice that?
No.
It says Bayland Garden. Right, boxing. So there's an advertisement on the wall there when they're in the 1930 scene, and it is to mirror the City on the Edge of Forever, the original series episode where they go back to the 1930s. And is a poster that says about at the Madison Square Garden, clearly, because it's, you know, and they made it Bayland Garden. So they were trying to do this
little
parallel
Easter egg or
little
something.
Easter egg, yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
One of the things we were trying to do also, we were trying to make sure that the times that they transported back to were all kind of weirdly crisis times. So it was like the Great Depression, the 60s in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So we were trying to sort of like say that like the places, and then they go back to a time when things are really horrible.
Yeah.
So the idea being that like, for whatever reason, you know, these are all sort of crisis points. These are all times when people were unemployed, where people were struggling, when people were rebelling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like
super
that.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
I also like that they kept beaming back to the same spot. So you kept seeing the same kind of spot.
Yeah, we knew where they landed.
Yeah. Well, we go back to the processing center. We're in Lee's cubicle area. Mm-hmm. BC is not happy about all these gimmies that are here. But they talk about how they can help and they can be trusted. And BC admits that he can't trust any of the other ghosts either. He can't trust the people like him. Mm-hmm. He's going to go make his demands, though. His demands are going to be, we'll give you the hostages for freedom. Mm-hmm. I love this detail that he wants to go to Tasmania because Errol Flynn was born
in Tasmania. Yes. Did you come up with that, Robert Hewitt Wolf?
No, I think that was an Ira one. Ira was the one that was mildly obsessed with Errol Flynn.
Yeah, it was very specific. I didn't know that Errol Flynn was from Tasmania.
Would mean he's Australian. So that's I had no clue he was an Aussie. So, all right.
Very cool. Well, Sisko says, no, that's not going to be our demand. We're not going to Tasmania. We're going to demand that they shut down these sanctuaries and reinstate the Federal Jobs Act. So he really wants to try to do what he knows happened. He wants to make sure that that continues to happen in this timeline. And Sisko says he wants to send Webb because they won't dismiss him as easily as us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was interesting.
It was a great point. Put that fine of a point on it. It was super clear. It's like, they won't.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't.
Webb is an acceptable face. He's the everyman. He's the guy. He's a family man. It's just very clear that if Webb is in trouble, then it's not. You can't just make an excuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I had mixed feelings about that commentary, because especially Sisko delivering that line, because here's a black man saying, I get they're not going to listen to me. We got to send the white guy in there. And that to me was a sad commentary on
systemic some of those
realities. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And honestly, I don't think he's comfortable with it, but he knows the truth. Mm-hmm. He's speaking what's true.
Yeah.
That he doesn't let his opinion or his feelings about it get in the way. He doesn't get angry about it. He's just stating facts.
It's a fact. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously BC, he's so unstable. There's no way anybody would listen to him.
No.
On top of the fact that he was really young. So there's this young, unstable man.
Mm-hmm.
And sad commentary, but mm-hmm. he speaks the truth.
Yeah. Well, we go over to the terminal in the processing center. Webb tries to make a call. He starts talking, but he gets cut off right away. BC is mad. That actor that played BC, he exploded in this moment. And then Vin calls BC a loser and says the National Guard is going to roll right over him like they aren't even here. When suddenly Preston, who is a negotiator, I guess, the hostage negotiator, Preston appears on the monitor, and she wants to see the hostages, make sure they're safe. So BC drags Lee over there. I thought it was interesting, though, because, we all have laptops or phones that we can turn around. Like, the fact they had to bring him over to this giant monitor table, nowadays, if I'm on a FaceTime or something, I just turn the camera and, see this.
Yeah.
Anyway, they got to bring all the hostages over one by one.
I like that actress too.
We really scored with our guest cast in these mm-hmm. episodes. Yeah. I mean, she was a regular on a sitcom for 5 years. She has
what?
Yeah,
she looks super familiar.
What did she?
Me.
Which sitcom did
too
she
close
do?
For Comfort. She was the oldest.
Oh, really?
Get out!
I don't know if she's still working, but she's had a great career. But after that, did a lot of these kind of like 1-2 episode guest arcs. And in a part that honestly is like not the most pivotal part in the entire thing, but still she has empathy. You can see that she cares, and she's in a difficult position. She's just yet another middle manager. And I just thought her performance was really good.
Well, Preston wants to see these hostages. They got to march them over. BC threatens that if we don't get what we want, these hostages are all going to get hurt.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we come back from our commercial break. Preston wants to talk to Webb now. BC's got a really bad temper in the scene. Cisco walks him away from everybody. And he says, it looks like you really just want to hurt someone. And BC agrees. He's like, yeah, I might feel better if I could. And Cisco gives him some advice, as you know, you're going to have to find a better way to deal with those feelings, which I love that moment too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like Cisco wasn't judging him or criticizing him. It was just, again, it was just fact. Like, you need to deal with these feelings. I get why you're angry. I get why you're frustrated, but mm-hmm. you know, hurting people is not the answer, which I thought was great.
Yeah. And he maintains his dignity, Cisco. It's like, yeah. you know, I am not going to veer from the path of not destroying any more of the timeline than we already have.
Yeah.
So he's not going to buy into anybody's poking at him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think he carries himself. I mean, obviously Avery always did, but he carries himself this episode with a great focus. And like, yeah, he's a Federation guy. He does on some level understand that this is a broken person. And the things that he's doing are because he's a broken person. That's the Federation perspective. Mm-hmm. Also, from the perspective of trying to get through this and get what he needs, he has to be nice. He sort of has to massage this guy when necessary, and then be tough with him when he has to be. And so he's being strategic, you know, but he also has a perspective of the person from the future looking at the past.
I like BC's response, though, when Cisco says, you'd better find a way to deal with that stress. It's sure to be a lot healthier for you in the long run. And then BC says, no kidding. Let me ask you something. And then he flips his hat up. You think it looks better like this or like this? It was just, just didn't give a straight answer or response. He just went right for what makes me look better. At the end of this, Preston asks Webb if they can meet to talk about this. And Cisco asks to join Webb. So reasonable heads are going to go out and talk to this negotiator.
Not BC and the fedora.
No. They go out by the main gate, and Preston has basically made an offer to Cisco and Webb to give them some food in exchange for one of the hostages. Mm-hmm. And Cisco says no hostage is going to be released until we get what we want, which is that Jobs Act, the Federal Jobs Act, and the thing shut down. But Preston does seem, you know, to be movable on this point. And she says, okay, I can't make any promises, but I'm going to talk to the governor, see what he thinks. So it feels like maybe Cisco is succeeding.
I think Preston is genuinely concerned and wants a peaceful outcome. And also, like, there's that really nice line where she says, I'm going to feed you no matter what. Like, you're going to get this food no matter what. I mean, on two levels, like, it shows that she cares. And then also, like, that's good hostage negotiation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you're sort of getting people on your side.
I'm here to help you. Yeah. I'm your friend. Smart. Exactly. Yeah,
and as a viewer, it's a nice scene. It feels like it kind of calms you down from being so stressed about what's going to happen. It's nice to have a little reprieve.
Yeah.
It's just a smart thing to do, right? We all feel a little bit satiated from the scary energy that's happening, but there's still more to come.
Yeah. I felt like this is a very Renee bit, to be honest, because like Renee was always like trying to bring sort of unexpected humanity to characters that in a lot of times, a lot of shows, you wouldn't bother with Preston being like, you know, the typical way to do this back in those days. But even now would just be tough as nails cop and just like hard nose all the time. And he just made it a really sympathetic character who was also empathetic.
Yes.
And I thought that was a really nice touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you trusted her.
Yeah.
She seems reasonable.
We have this tragedy. We know it's not going to end well, but we can see that this person is trying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We go back into the processing center. Was this a set built on stage? I assume it was.
Yes, I believe it seems, so.
Yeah,
that sounds right.
Was 17 our revolving? We had a revolving set in there, and we had the caves.
We had the caves on the way and back. Then all that space that we eventually filled up so much that you could barely walk through there.
Yes. Yeah. We put the Defiant in there.
Yeah. Once we put the Defiant in there and then more pieces of the Defiant. Terry, remember the Deep Space Nine maze game signs that they put up?
Maze game. No, I forgot.
What is that?
Oh my God. I can't believe I forgot.
Once that stage got super, super full, construction put up these signs that said, "Welcome to the Deep Space Nine maze game. Good luck."
That's funny.
Basically, like, just finding your way through that stage was insane. I mean, you just couldn't get through. You would end up in dead ends, and like, it was impossible.
And our sets were so intense. I mean, we could have worked there 20 years.
Wow.
They were so solid.
Yeah.
They were amazing.
We go back into the processing center.
Yes.
This is where Bashir is helping Lee, the lady that worked there. Yeah. She doesn't feel well. Bashir realizes, you know, he can feel, I guess, just her sweaty kind of hypoglycemic attack that she's having. He kind of figures that
she's
out.
She's clammy.
He can see it too. He can see the perspiration. Without
I had hypoglycemia while we were filming. Mm. Yeah. It's really bad. It's hard. Yeah. Yeah.
So you need sugar then. You need something to bring it.
Yeah, you need to maintain your blood sugar level because you create too much insulin.
Got it.
So your body's, basically your metabolism is just working super fast.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, she is having a hypoglycemic attack. Bashir goes to help her. Sisko comes back. She asks about Sisko. She talks about when they checked in, that she was the one that checked them in. And Bashir calls him Gabriel Bell. And she's like, "Oh, well, he must have given me a false name when he first checked in." Mm-hmm. And this is where she shares a story about a woman that that she checked in one time that she felt sorry for. She didn't log her in, let her disappear into the sanctuary. That this woman was brought into the sanctuary just because she didn't have enough money, I guess, to help her to take care of her daughter. And so she'd given the daughter to relatives or something. But her punishment was, throw her in the sanctuary. She's, you know.
Yeah. Not, for child not abandonment.
Responsible. Yeah, exactly. And it was very sweet that, you know, you see this woman who works in the system, but sees all the flaws of the system, but still, you know, can't do much about it.
But she does what she can.
She says, "Don't blame yourself for how things are." And I like her last line there where she basically says, you know, that's what everybody says. Don't blame myself, but nothing ever changes. If that's how we all act. So again, a nice lesson about, you know, every little bit will help if it's a step in the right direction. So whatever you can do. Yeah.
Again, like, you know, it's the whole idea that the Federation is founded on the idea of everyone pitching in and doing the things that need to be done to make paradise happen, which has always been like a big theme on Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is like, paradise doesn't come for free. You have to earn it. And this is a seminal event that helped form the Federation, and it made people realize that.
Yeah, we have to fight for it all the time, our freedom. Yeah.
There is a little bit of a passage of time. We're still in the processing center and people are asleep. BC is asleep. He's one of the sleep people. Sisko, I think, relieves someone on sleep duty.
Yeah, Sisko's kind of walking and yawning. He's
walking around. Yeah. Well, Vin is wide awake and he notices that BC's asleep. So he tries to do the old sneaky, get out of here. Yeah, tiptoe out. But Sisko sees him. No, BC sees him, right? BC wakes up and sees him and pumps his shotgun and he's about to shoot Vin. There's a standoff. Sisko is like, "No, don't do it. Don't do it." And I just love it. When BC says, "Well, give me one reason why not to." And Sisko's like, "Okay." And he pumps his shotgun and points it at Vin. But then later the dialogue gets pretty darn hilarious because BC's like, "I thought we're on the same side." And Sisko's like, "Yeah, we are. But you get on my nerves. And I don't like your hat," which I is, again, that's very funny.
Yeah.
The dialogue. Put the gun down. "I don't like your hat." Like, you have to put that in there, but it makes us laugh. As
well, he's speaking BC's language too.
For sure,
this moment he's got to talk in a way that
like
BC
a ghost
understands.
Like a ghost.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, Avery just turns on his scary Avery, you know.
Yes.
Scary Sisko bit there, which is like that, like, I will out crazy you, I will out scary yes. you. you know, which is somewhat unique to Sisko as a Star
as a
Trek
captain.
Captain. I think, you know, he had that gear that I don't think any of our other captains have ever really had.
Right.
Yeah.
Where he could just be like, oh shit. You know?
Yeah.
So I thought that was
great. He can tap into intense like nobody.
Yeah.
I've stood 100%. Toe-to-toe with that intense, and it's something exhilarating to work with someone that's that upset and so focused.
Yeah.
It helps you stay in your focus too.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, you'll just crumble and the scene will die. Yeah.
It's funny because because Sisko becomes Sisko, it gives Webb a little confidence. Webb actually walks up to BC right in front of the gun and just grabs the shotgun and
the
pushes
barrel.
It down. Yeah. Because you heard the man. And BC backs down. He backs down. Yeah. He goes, you gimmies, no sense of fun. And he walks, you know, kind of away a little bit. But Sisko at this point is really, really pissed because he feels like Vin is constantly undermining his ability to keep Vin alive, basically. So Sisko calls Vin over and he's just like, hey, and he kind of roughs him up a little bit. He's
mad.
He's so mad. I've never seen him that mad on DS9 to this point. He went Sisko to the next level. Like he went to
Sisko
another
square
because he's
Sisko
saving square. The timeline. Sisko square. He has to save the timeline.
Yes.
Yeah.
He has to. It's imperative or we're going to vanish.
It's Dick Miller. Dick Miller's not backing down.
No, Dick Miller doesn't back down to anything. That's true.
Yeah. So you got to go to 10 to get Dick Miller to back down, man.
Exactly. Yes. So BC got Sisko'd. Vin got a double, like Robbie said, Sisko squared. He got a double
espresso.
Is what he did. Double espresso. Double Sisko, please. Yes.
He also knows that in the timeline that the hostages all need to survive.
Yeah.
So he's got to keep Vin alive.
Yes. Yeah. They all have to. Because
that would mess it up.
One dying will ruin the timeline entirely. Every single one has to remain alive. Right. But I just love Sisko's final statement to Vin. He says, you get back in that room and you shut up. And it's just like, yes.
I also like in this scene, this is the beginning of Vin sort of cracking a little bit because he admits.
Yes.
Oh, what do you want me to say? That I feel for them, that they have a bad break? What good would it do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you see that he's aware,
just
like Lee, you know, Lee sees the problems of the system. Vin sees them
too. They feel helpless.
Yeah.
And they each cover it in different ways. I mean, Lee just tries to keep her head down. You know, Bernardo is completely focused on family and just like, this is just a job. I punch the clock. I go home to my family. He's all about his family.
Mm-hmm.
And Vin just has this attitude that he's just like completely dismissing these, he's dehumanizing them to the point where he can do his job by just basically not even thinking of them as people anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what Sisko is partially poking at as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of, you know, you can see the system is kind of grinding down not only the people who are trapped here, but the people who are supposed to, you know, keep them this way. It's dehumanizing for them as well.
So they're all victimized.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in the Stanford prison experiment, no one walks away feeling good about themselves.
Right.
That's kind of what we're going for here a little bit. I just want to talk about one of my pet peeves as a producer, which is the infinitely rackable shotguns in this episode. There's a lot of shotgun racking and like gratuitous because it just makes a cool
pumping
sound.
Yeah,
but it works for the episode. I get it. I understand why Jonathan had and the actors are constantly racking their shotguns.
Yeah, you have to shoot them to be able to rack to the next.
Yeah, well, or you're injecting loaded cartridges which never eject either, which
it's not
really how guns
but
work,
it's a but, scary sound
but it is a scary sound.
It alerts everyone.
After Voyager, I did a lot of procedurals, cop shows and things like that. And then when you go back onto a sci-fi set where they're sort of loose with the rules, I'm like, you wouldn't walk around this corner without drawing a weapon or being safe, you know? So I've found the procedurals being able to work in that space has helped in the sci-fi space a bit too, you know, keeping it real.
The same for me. I think because after I did all these science fiction shows, I did go off and do, you know, I've done a bunch of procedurals too and subsequently, and it's just like you just get in your head the real rules of how to handle weapons, and then you're on a sci-fi show, and it's just like,
you wouldn't do that.
No,
that's not a smart move. No, the next shot, we're back in the same spot where Kira and O'Brien beamed in before. Mm-hmm. We see a VW kind of camper van with flowers on it. So we know it's a different timeline.
It's the 60s.
The advertisement has changed. The ad that was there with Madison Square Garden boxing in the 30s
now says
Berman's Rainbow Dreamers. It's a band. So we got Rick Berman got to put his family name in there. Yeah. And Berman's Rainbow Dreamers are performing at the Bear, as in Ira Stephen Bear Theater. So Ira got to have his surname.
Oh, that's
too.
Funny.
Yeah.
That's very funny. I love it. You got these hippies. You've got the loud music. There's the peace sign bit that I love. The girl and the guy get out of the van. The girl sort of, I think she gives Kira a flower.
She gives them each a flower.
Gives them a flower. And the peace sign bit is funny.
So cute, because they don't know what it is.
No.
Like,
no. Okay. They do it very hesitantly, yes. They're like, is this a hello? We don't know.
Very awkwardly.
My favorite is, because it's an automatic beam out that happens after 60 seconds or whatever it is, I just love O'Brien's, uh-oh. Now these people are seeing the other, beam out,
like,
right?
Wow.
Like,
they're so high.
Let's smoke another J. Yeah, exactly.
I don't think they need more after that.
No, after that one, after the beam out. Oh my gosh.
Well, we go back to the processing center. The food's arrived. They've got some food. Webb's son arrives as well. He wants to be with his dad. He does tell his dad that mom and sis are safe. And Webb sort of reluctantly agrees, but he says, if I tell you to leave, you're going to have to leave. Mm-hmm. You can stay here for now, but if things get bad, you're going to have to leave. Mm-hmm. And then we see Bashir has found some medicine for Lee. So he gives her an injection. And Bernardo's looking at his family picture. Bashir sees that photo. And Bashir sort of, without giving away the fact that they know the historical record, he wants to reassure, like, Bernardo about his family and Lee and everybody. And he says, you know, this is going to be worth it. Things are going to change.
Yep.
You know, he picked up on how they were feeling and was able to kind of, without breaking the rules or showing, you know, all the details, he was able to reassure them in that moment. It was nice. Mm-hmm.
I love Bashir's energy throughout this entire episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's very grounded.
Yeah. Very grounded. It's really nice to see him be in command of what he knows. He seems really calm and totally in sync with being a really good partner to Sisko.
Yeah.
The two episodes where Bashir's character, I think, finally kind of turns the corner.
Yeah,
from being the sort of, he kind of has fully grown up by these episodes, which is cool. The thing, though, is even when he was sort of callow and hitting on everything that moved and everything, when he first showed up and unintentionally being kind of colonial and all that stuff, he was always still a really good doctor. And I think that that this is his bedside manner that we're seeing. We see him diagnose somebody, calm her down, you know, calm Bernardo down. This is the interpersonal skill part of being a doctor that he's actually very, very good at. I think that that was one of the things that we always, even when Bashir was being kind of an oaf, but he was always a really good doctor. And that's was really important to us. And so we were very much leaning into his doctor persona.
Let's have a little quote from Alexander Siddig. He said he felt that both Past Tense Part 1 and Past Tense Part 2 were important shows for Bashir. This show was the end of the old Bashir and the beginning of the new, more responsible Bashir. He remarked, Bashir had proved to everyone and himself that he can handle very tricky situations with almost no backup and no gizmos, not even the shotgun Sisko had. It became conceivable that Bashir would be your first or second choice on an away team if you were going on a combat mission. I think they were a renaissance pair of shows for Bashir, is what Sid said. Wow. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the intention. And I think the intention of us as writers, but also his intention, because Sid was totally on board with making the character look terrible at the beginning, you know,
right.
and sort of being aware that he would have a 7-year arc with this character where he would be maturing throughout the show. And that was really going to be his arc. And I think he embraced that. I mean, early on, a lot of fans did not like Bashir and they were, the testing on him was very bad. And it was like, yes, really? This is intentional. He's not supposed to be your favorite character. He's supposed to be a character that annoys you and says stupid things and does stupid things because he's a 28-year-old hotshot out of the academy.
Yeah.
Who's like also, you know, overcompensating for some things. And and he is going to grow. You know? And that was always the plan. And this is really sort of a crew. As Sid points out, kind of crucial part of his growth is these episodes.
You had arcs for all of us. There's nothing more fun, I don't think anyway, than watching a show and having each character have an arc.
Yeah.
Because it satisfies us as human beings watching that too, because we like to think that we're going to get better at what we do or we're going to be more healed. And to be able to watch that in Deep Space Nine, I think it's one of the things the fans really enjoy is watching the character development. They really appreciate it.
I mean, again, like we had such a terrific cast that was able to do these kind of like, it's very hard to show slow growth over 170 something episodes. Both as writers, but as cast too, like rewatching these episodes, I very much admire seeing how each of you sort of understood where you started and where you were going and sort of where you were in the process in any given episode, you know? And I think that that's just, it's a gift to the writers to know that we can give these scenes to people. And also I think a gift to the fans because the show then has these really lovely long-term arcs for the characters that they can appreciate on like rewatch as they were watching, but also nowadays streaming them.
And it's fun. I think that's the best part about being in a series is not only, you know, the camaraderie on the set and working together, but having a job where you're constantly growing and finding out new things. And it might not be every episode. There might be spans of time where you're keeping the status quo. But that's important too. That's important too. So yeah, thank you.
Oh, awesome. Thank you guys.
I find it interesting, Robert, that you said that there was a lot of critique of Bashir season one too. Whereas Robbie and I were definitely team Bashir. We liked the oaf that we saw in the beginning.
Yes,
he made us laugh. He really did. So we waved the team Bashir flag season one and two. And we're definitely fans of him watching him mature as well. Yeah. So.
I just thought it was a very clever bit of planning by Michael, knowing that the show was going to be on, you know, pretty much knowing we would get 7 years or having faith that we would, and knowing you could start a character in this place where he would be, you know, would put his foot in his mouth frequently and, you know, make you cringe, and knowing that you would get to where he gets to by the end, where he is like an admirable Starfleet officer and amazing doctor and a guy who's been through it. And, you know, also just same thing, Dax, someone who just has gotten this symbiote and is struggling to sort of understand all these past lives and is now very aware of them, but is confusing. And it's trying to find her own identity as a sort of hybrid between herself and all these past identities to where she gets to by the end. Well, unfortunately.
Yes.
But by the time she gets there, she's much more integrated. She's much more kind of like at ease with herself and has gone through this journey and has figured it out. And she's already very far along here.
Yeah, I think so too.
So we're at the Sanctuary main gate again. Preston's back. And she tells Webb and Sisko that the governor's willing to reduce the charges and look into the matter of, you know, some of their complaints if they free all the hostages. And Sisko says, well, nothing's going to change. He's going to form a committee? Like, no. Mm-hmm. And then Webb gets really wound up and basically insists on their demands. And he says, if they ever want to see these hostages again, they better do what we're asking. And they walk off. And I think this is when, as they're walking off, Sisko goes, tough talk. And Webb goes, yeah, I was bluffing. I couldn't tell. So it was nice. And I like the way Frakes did this sort of high wide shot of them walking away.
Yeah.
He didn't cover those lines at the end. He just let it play and sort of the heroes walking off in the sunset kind of shot. It was nice. Mm-hmm. Really good. Now we're getting to a very exciting moment where a manhole cover starts moving around in the middle of the street.
Yeah. And it's not a sanitation worker. It's Dax
it's not.
Who comes
it's
out of there.
Dax, yes.
Surprise.
Surprise. Mm-hmm. And I might add, a very well-coiffed and very clean Dax who just emerges from the sewers. I was like, what?
She's just that good.
A cat. You know, cats can clean themselves. Dax can clean herself.
Okay. Dax is a cat. Jerry Bona used to complain he couldn't keep the dirt on me. They put fake dirt on me. I don't think they did in this scene, but
that's
they
funny.
Would. And then it would just, like, where'd it go? I'm like, I promise you, I didn't touch it.
I can't help it. I'm
like,
just
I only sweated from here down. My face never got sweaty. It was so weird.
Dax doesn't seem to have any problem moving that manhole cover, which makes me say that, like, she's strong. She's very strong.
You know what they call that? They call that farm strong. You know, that's the type of strength.
Iowa strong.
Iowa farm strong. Yes.
Well, I didn't grow up in a farm.
Okay.
But yeah, it's the corn.
Do you remember being down in that manhole? What was down there?
Yeah.
Nothing. It's just you're just a in a
end?
Cylinder. Like
it's a fake. It was
a fake
sewer hole, right?
Yes.
There was no real sewer there.
No.
No.
Okay.
And I remember pretending to make it difficult to move.
Were you claustrophobic though?
No, I know how to breathe and all of that through stuff like that. So I'm pretty good. I mean, there are some times when it gets me shook up, but overall, no, I would not.
Okay.
Label myself as somebody who's claustrophobic.
Got it.
I am.
I'm sorry.
Claustrophobic.
But the manhole was fake, though, Terry. It was a fake manhole.
Oh
cover.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it was light. I mean, it's there on the Paramount lot. It's made to withstand weather and
so
everything.
So it's actually metal. It's a metal steel.
It's not iron.
Right? It's not
it's
iron.
It's not like a real.
It's not a real manhole.
Yeah. I know, but the cover itself.
Right, but
was
there's
fake
some
too.
Weight to it because. I don't remember if it was rubber or not. I mean, it could have been a really hard rubber.
Mm. Well, you faked it good.
Later, though, Sid slides it over, and he makes it seem like it weighs a ton.
Yes,
yeah,
he does.
So he does.
Clearly, Dax is much stronger than
Much stronger, yes.
Which is probably true anyway.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, as Dax starts walking down the street, we reveal Clint Howard. Is following her.
Yeah.
Oh,
I love it. I didn't look at the cast list before.
Joy.
So this is the first moment I was like, oh my God, it's Clint Howard.
Oh my God. We were all excited. But now that we know that it was written for Iggy Pop, boy, that would have been even creepier to watch Iggy Pop pop out of there.
That might have been scary.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's what they were going for. Because Clint makes me smile. He doesn't scare me. Clint Howard makes me, he was in the original series.
Yeah.
5,000 other roles. So,
yeah. Well, we go back to the processing center. Sisko and Bashir cannot access the interwebs whatever they called it back then.
Interface.
The interface. They can't access it. And Sisko says, you know, according to history, they told their story to millions of people. So we have to make sure this happens. We've got to get connected. That's when Dax is brought in by some dims and BC. What does BC say? Listen up. A couple of dims just brought us a little present. Mm-hmm. And there we see Dax without her comm badge, though.
Right.
Well, BC seems in love with Dax. Bashir comes over and hugs Dax. So to BC, it looks like you're a couple.
And I didn't mind in that moment. Dax did not mind.
Well,
he shook her up a little bit. He's a little unnerving, that guy.
He introduces himself to Dax. And now we know what BC stands for. Biddle Coleridge.
Yes.
What a name. Did you come up with that, Robert Hewitt Wolf?
I think Ira and I came up with that when we first were introducing him. And we just thought he must have some ridiculous first name.
And you got it.
Biddle Coleridge.
Biddle Coleridge. I love it.
My name were Biddle, I would also use BC. That's why he's so messed up.
Oh, I get it.
Messed him up with their name. The guy had no chance.
But your names are awesome. The DS9 names are way better than the Voyager names, I feel, so far.
Yeah, good names.
I've seen good names.
I like Biddle Coleridge.
Zipatoy. Come on. Let's go.
Well, Bashir reminds Dax, you remember your good friend, my good friend, Gabriel Bell. So he's kind of trying to help get her to play along, which she does.
I love these moments because these are so quintessential old Star Trek for me.
Yeah.
When it's like watching the team kind of play along. It's like, look how good they are. They just roll with it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, Dax totally rolled with it.
Yeah.
And Dax explains that she recoded her ID card so she could get past the sanitation department checkpoint. That's when BC's like, what? You crawled through the sewers? You must really like these guys.
And that's when I said, oh, they did not put anything to make it look like she crawled through sewers. No, she came on a metro, you know, I don't know. She came on the subway. It didn't look
she
like
just hovered over that poop.
Yes. She got.
You don't know that I can fly. Yes.
We didn't know
I
you're
keep
Mary
it
Poppins.
Secret.
Yes. Dax is also Mary Poppins, is able to
yes,
levitate
she is.
Over all the poo, which is amazing. It's so good.
She re-engineered her comm badge into an anti-gravity belt.
Yes,
exactly.
Just re-engineered. She's so smart. She was able to hover just, over the poop.
Sure,
yes.
Sure. I just wanted to go back to you very quickly was when Terry was talking about how everybody, or you guys were talking about how everyone's really good at what they're doing. There's a theory, it's called, I don't remember what it's called, but basically we used to call it the Hoxine professional. People love to watch competence. That's one of the things that's one of the secrets to Star Trek is that everyone is really competent and well-intentioned and they work really hard and they're very good at their jobs. And people enjoy watching people who are good at what they're doing. And this is sort of an example of our characters as these, as we would just call them the Hoxian professionals after Howard Hawks, the director, who would always make sure that in his movies, the characters were all sort of good at what they do. And that was just one of his, I think it was his theory or someone's theory that he embraced in his storytelling and that he embraced too.
And I think in comedy, it's always fun in comedy to watch people not be good at what they're doing.
Yes. 100%.
Like right. Lucille Ball.
But they're trying so hard to be good at it, but they just miss it.
Yeah.
But in a heroic drama, you want everyone to be great at their jobs, but then be in these situations where it's almost impossible for them to succeed anyway, despite their competence, and then see how they
figure it out.
Yeah.
Well, we go over to Lee's cubicle next. Dax understands that Sisko's going to stay here, that he's determined to correct the timeline and he's not just going to bail out of here. So Sisko tells them to find Dax's comm badge and he'll meet them at the Beeman site. And if he's not there, that they should just leave him. So a real heroic sacrifice.
Huge.
For Sisko here. Bashir also says that Dax needs to get out of here because she's alien and you know, if she were to get arrested or doctors were to check her out, they'd figure that out pretty quickly. So she's got to get off this this timeline, out of this timeline.
Yeah.
But Bashir also, in a heroic way, says, I'll take her to get her comm badge. I'll get her out of here, but I want to come back. He tells Sisko, you know, I want to come back and help you. And Sisko agrees.
But also, this is the scene where Dax says that she can help with the internet, the blocked internet, right? So she has an idea.
Oh, and the other thing that comes out in the scene is I think Dax mentions that her comm badge that they took from her is emitting a distress signal, a subspace distress signal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of important for us to know later on. It's going to help them get out of here. Yeah, we go back out into the sanctuary district where everybody lives. Dax is showing Bashir where she was taken. And Bashir's hopeful that Chris can help him get back on the net to send out this message as it happened historically, millions of people need to see the message. When they get inside, there's Grady, Clint Howard, and he tries to be invisible. I love the moment where he's like,
he went whoosh, right? I'm invisible. It was so cute.
That's a great old moment.
Yeah, super sweet little scene.
You can still see me, and Bashir's like barely.
No, he's like, as long as they can't see me. And Dax says, who? And Grady goes, the aliens. They'll suck your brains out right through your ears.
It's great dialogue in this scene.
So good.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. Dax admits she's an alien in the scene to Grady. But Grady says, oh, you're a good alien, though.
To protect Earth. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. She says she's here to protect Earth from its enemies.
Right.
But she needs that piece of jewelry back that he took.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives it back and Dax says, don't tell anybody. Mm-hmm. And he agrees. So great little scene. Great, great, sweet moment. Very sweet. Back in the street, Dax is going back into the poop tube.
Is this where Bashir barely moves the cover? Is this the scene?
Yeah, he's acting
the one
like
that
the heaviest.
Just flings open. Yeah. Okay.
Well, no, to be fair, like Terry does play it as heavy, but Bashir plays it as like it weighs twice as much as it weighs.
Yes, he does. He really does.
And knowing Sid, he wouldn't be offended. He'd be laughing at us right now.
Oh, well, I'm sure.
Because it probably was heavier for me.
Yeah, Dax goes down in the sewer. Bashir runs off. And then we cut a little time jump. Dax is in Chris's office next.
Mm-hmm. Totally clean because she levitated over the poop again when she went.
Oh, yeah. Oh, she looks
and I
great.
Smell like a rose.
You do.
Exactly. No sweat, no dirt, nothing. Yeah. She's trying to convince Chris to help her reestablish the net connection. Mm-hmm. He says he's going to lose his license if he does that, but he does mention, but I'll get some good ratings.
Which sounded very much like a Ted Turner line.
Yes. Yes. That is a Ted Turner line.
Yeah. That.
But Dax also gets the situation here. Like she, you know, she's very sympathetic to what's going on because she's got a great speech. You know, sooner or later, the government's going to retake this place. And when they do, people are going to die. She's very sympathetic with this. And we go back in the processing center. All of these gimmies are there telling their stories to the world. So we've got this guy named Henry talking about how he came to work at a brewery, but he just got laid off and then ended up here. In Henry's story, he talks about working at this brewery and they got some new equipment. So technology kind of took over his job, which I thought was an interesting little detail about, I mean, look at AI now. Look at what's happening in our lives.
That was our imagined reason for all this unemployment was the idea that automation was increasing. Mm-hmm. I just want to shout out Daniel Zacapa here because he's a day player. And I don't know whether people are aware of what that means, but basically it means that you're brought on to do like one day's work. Usually that's a line or two and you're not like for example the guy who leads the assault later, same kind of thing. But Daniel has to give this really heartfelt speech about his backstory and how he got here, and he does a great job, and that is not easy to do as an actor. And so I think, you know, it's definitely worth pointing out that
absolutely
this guy is like coming in. He's here only one day. He really has no
status or
status, knowledge of the show, probably, or very little. He doesn't really even interact with anybody. He just has to give this one heartfelt speech, and he totally nails it.
He nailed it. Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah,
really,
100%. Really
good. When he was doing this beautiful speech, I was mesmerized by him, but I was also aware behind him was a background actor who looked like Amelia Earhart to me. It's like, is Amelia Earhart?
That was just for you, Robbie. Yeah, for this moment.
I was like, what is Amelia Earhart doing in this? Her hair, her outfit, everything looked like Amelia Earhart. Like, what?
Yeah, now we know. Her plane crashed in the sanctuary. That's where it was. Yes. She went through a time warp and that's what happened. Okay.
Yeah. Back outside. And Preston is on the phone trying to get some more time from the governor.
Yeah.
I just noticed her cell phone looked like a Motorola flip phone, but a large one. Like, do you remember in the 90s, the bigger one, they had the big battery and it had the, not the Razor, that was tiny, but the big flippies.
Yeah.
It looked a lot like that to me.
Yeah. You know, what's weird is I usually, when I watch this for the first time, I turn on the, subtitles just to see alien, you know, names and whatever. And it's usually pretty precise. Whatever someone says on screen, you see it in the subtitles. This is the first episode where it was not correct because you hear the background. Yeah. You hear in the background some voiceover of someone making an announcement, like over it says governor, blah, 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 has decided that there's like an overall, like an announcement thing.
Yeah.
But it clearly to me says that it was Governor Chen is da, 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 da. But then on screen it said Governor Rivers. So they totally changed I was so confused. I was like,
it's the way they have multiple governors in the future.
Very strange.
They got like a dozen of them. They got a bunch of governors.
Fine. All right.
Yeah.
I believe in Picard, they shout out Governor Chen. There's like some graffiti, you know.
Really?
No,
Governor
really?
Chen resign or something. There's like some, there's some graffiti in the background when they go to LA in 2024 in Picard that shouts out Governor Chen and very unpopular governor, Governor Chen.
Wow. C-H-E-N though, right? So C-H-E-N, it's the Chinese spelling. So I could play the unpopular Governor Chen now.
That's in the canon. Yes, absolutely. Well, I did like in this scene that Preston had a sidekick, an older guy. Do you remember the guy that was standing there while she was on the phone?
Yes.
And then somebody came over and whispered in his ear, and then they left. Like all this business is going on.
Yes.
And then at the end, Preston turns to him and says, the governor's made up his mind. We move in at 0500.
Yeah.
And the silent sidekick just nods
and walks off.
But I was like, he was doing a good, he had a whole bunch of life going on.
He did.
For a no line role.
Yeah.
I think, you know, credit also to Frakes for that. It's a very lively episode with regard to that. It feels even bigger than it is. And that's partially because he, you know, invested a lot of the background or day players or extras with stuff, you know, or had the ADs do it, depending on whether they were extras or paid actors. He really kept all that with like the background dims, the background ghosts, the, you know, the cops, the people outside. Everyone is moving with purpose, you know, constantly. And there's no people just like where you're looking at them like, what the hell is that person even doing? You know, they're all very specific.
Yeah. Really. 'Cause if they don't know what they're doing, it ruins the scene.
It can, but not in this case.
Good job, Frakes.
Well, the next scene is in the transporter room back on the Defiant. They're trying to figure out this timeline, like where they need to go. And this is where they basically realize the last time that they jumped, they were in the year 2048, and they know it has to be before that because what they saw in that 2048 timeline had changed from the history book. So they've narrowed it down to like three times, and they only have enough chronoton particles for one more jump. So Kira says, well, Chief, pick one. Let's hope you get lucky. And I love when Miles is kind of looking at the times and he's like, and he just points at one. It's like, let's do that one. It seems so random. Yes. He goes, that's my best guess. I don't know.
I mean, he is making an educated guess. Like the way Colm plays it, he plays it kind of like a little for comedy.
Yeah.
But the idea is that O'Brien is looking at these events and thinking, well, what could have produced what we just saw in 2048 or whatever it was?
Yeah. Yeah.
And if this didn't happen, let's try this. You know, it is his best guess, but it's not completely a shot in the dark.
Uneducated. Right. Yeah. Well, they make the guess, they beam out, and we go down to a San Francisco street, and they made it. Miles picks up immediately a subspace distress signal, and Kira starts calling for Dax in Chris's office. Dax was sleeping or napping.
I was exhausted. Imagine. Would have been nice if I were on a couch instead of slumped in a chair.
In the chair.
I mean, doesn't that man have enough money to have a couch in his office?
I would think so. He's Ted Turner, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So if the comm badge is removed from your uniform, it automatically gives off a subspace distress signal?
I said it.
You said it for that. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. Well, Dax wakes up, chats with Kira for a minute. Kira says the transporters are going to automatically beam them back in about a minute. So they deactivate their comm badges so they won't get beamed off yet. So they can have more time here.
Mm-hmm.
And Dax says she'll meet them where they're at. So they're going to hook up and get together and they'll reactivate their comm badges, you know, for tomorrow when the next beam out happens. So they've got a plan. We go to the processing center next. They're talking sports here. Vin, Bernardo, Cisco seem to all love baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Not Bashir. What does Bashir say? Doesn't he talk about
tennis?
Oh, he prefers tennis. That's right. Lee likes soccer. That's her game. So, but it's nice you see this bonding with Cisco and Vin and Bernardo because it's going to help. You know, it's all about kind of softening up Vin and Bernardo.
Yeah.
To work with them.
Right.
And it's a nice bonding. Yeah. And it's a conversation people have, which is kind of great. It's just And I love that they bring up that he, of course, talks about the Kings and Buck Buckeye because it's like, that's our time. That's
our universe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Also, we predicted that the 99 Yankees would win the World Series. I just want to just.
That's crazy.
Get out. Shut
that is
up.
Crazy that you guys did that. I just, because Vin says it, right? Vin says it was a 1999 New York Yankees. And in reality, the Yankees did win the World Series in 99. So you guys are like Nostradamus.
That's crazy.
It's unbelievable.
That's powerful intention.
Also, Ira is a huge Yankees fan.
I feel like you guys should get a World Series ring out of this. You basically predicted it.
Yeah. Here's another random tidbit. Sisko discusses the London Kings and Buck Bukai with Vin, played by Dick Miller. Both the player and the team were first mentioned during Dick Miller's first Star Trek appearance in Star Trek Next Generation episode, The Big Goodbye. So that's interesting there. That happened. Little connected.
I wasn't even aware of that.
Yeah,
that's crazy detail.
Yes.
BC says the National Guard, more National Guard are arriving, that something's up. They're on the move. That's when Webb tells his son he's going to have to leave for safety. They hug. It does feel that hug feels a little foreshadowy that like Webb's not going to see his son again.
I was waiting for them to just say, I love you. Because it's such a dangerous time. Even if it's not foreshadowing a death, which I was thinking, well, they probably didn't say I love you, because then that sort of says, uh-oh.
Too much foreshadowing, yeah.
Yeah, too much. But it's just a thing you do, especially when you're don't know when I'm going to see you next.
Yeah. I felt it, though. It was a nice, it was really nice non-dialogue moment, just the hug itself. And then BC gives him his hat, which is a big deal.
Which is another kind of like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. They're prepared to die. Yeah.
I kind of felt like that was his redemption moment, is that he kind of gave that hat to that kid, sort of like, look, you know, kid, I'm going to be dying for a cause, basically. Yeah. And this is my will, my one most precious item. Mm-hmm. This fedora, which could have been a beanie with a propeller. This fedora I'm going to give to you, young man. And you're going to, you know, carry on my legacy in a way. So,
In a way. It's interesting. Bill and I did a panel on past tense at the Las Vegas convention. And this was the moment he was talking. He remembered this specific moment as being like really powerful when BC gives his son the hat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the things we were talking about again, like, the Federation is made of small acts of human kindness. And in a weird way, this is like BC's nicest thing that BC does.
It is, for sure.
Because it's not his son. It's Webb's son that he gives it to. So that's huge.
But he also knows on some level that Webb is probably going to die, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, what he's saying is like, BC has a lot of issues, obviously. But one of them is that he's a survivor and he's strong, you know? And that he's able to, that at some level he's able to overcome or persevere through some pretty horrible circumstances. And so he's kind of giving the kid his armor,
his survivor kind of,
you know, the thing that he imbues with his ability to survive and be tough and be strong.
Interesting.
You know, just think it's a really nice moment.
It is a great moment.
Gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Well, they prepare for battle. We hear some helicopter sounds. The front doors blow open in a very dramatic onset effects shot. A gunfight happens. Webb is shot. Mm-hmm. BC is shot. Sisko even gets shot trying to protect Vin, who runs out. Vin's yelling at the cops, like, stop shooting. They have a little exchange and the police decide to move on because there's more trouble.
Here's where the police also say that there were rumors that you guys were dead. And Vin's like, do I look dead to you?
Yeah, so, exactly. which is part of that the history that Sisko talked about.
Yeah.
You know, everybody thought they were dead and they weren't. Mm-hmm. So everything's on track to get us back in the right timeline. Mm-hmm. Bashir does take a look at Sisko, who did get shot up in the shoulder area. Mm-hmm. Bashir says he's going to live. And then the scene ends with them going to check on Webb, but I don't know if we get a clear answer. At least it wasn't clear to me. Is Webb dead?
I thought he was dead for sure.
I thought he was dead too. He's dead, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting because they have trouble trying to access the net, and you have someone named Webb, as in the World Wide Web. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but yeah.
We cut outside onto the street, and it's now daylight. We can see casualties everywhere. This was a very clever twist because this whole episode, I was like, how is Sisko going to fake die or die? Yeah. Like, how is that part of the history going to be kept intact?
Yeah.
And Vin decides to let Sisko and Bashir go, but he thinks, I'll take your ID cards, put them on someone who has died.
Yeah.
And people will think that they died in the riot, and so you can escape.
Yeah.
Very clever.
Very.
Yeah. Simple genius. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So this is the one shot Jonathan whiffed on a little bit, to be honest.
Oh, really?
Because he was supposed to shoot it on a day where we had like 150 extras.
That was my point. Yeah.
With a crane that we also have. And we never have 150 extras. We never have a crane. And I don't know why, because we weren't on set. The writers weren't on set. But for some reason, that shot never got done.
Yeah.
Oh.
Whether he ran out of time or he just whiffed or he decided it wasn't worth the effort. Yeah. Frakes did not get that shot. And so we had to go back a few days later when we realized that he had nothing. He never had the shot with any kind of scope.
Oh, wow.
And just get as many extras as we could, and a ladder.
Instead of a crane, a ladder.
Instead of a crane, and
steal
got
a shot.
The shot, a steal a shot.
Ugh.
That's why it was so sparse. It was very.
That's why it was so sparse. Yeah. I mean, look, Frakes did a terrific job on this episode. Like you said, it got him the first contact job, and he did a great job.
Well, is this like literally? These are the first. This is the third show he's ever directed.
Third
DS9. He'd done a bunch of Next Generations as well now.
But still, it's like kind of new. It's not like he's got his 10,000 hours yet, right, in directing?
Yeah, right. And look, I mean, crane shots, as they say, are where the schedule goes to die.
Yeah. You
know? especially back then. Crane shots are really, can be really time consuming. And so I'm sure, you know, Frakes didn't just forget about it.
No, I'm sure they ran out of time.
No, there had to be a reason.
I'm sure it was, but he didn't Frakes never threw anyone else under the bus. He didn't like say, well, the ADs told me I couldn't get it or whatever.
Yeah.
He just took, he just took the blame.
Well, that's the kind of guy he is.
Yeah.
100%. Like,
yeah. I mean, the buck stops here, right? When you're the director.
Yeah, yeah, and Frakesy is definitely a guy who, and look, he's a stand-up guy. He's not gonna he's not going to throw Oster or
no.
You know, or somebody else under the bus for it. But you know, it was just tough.
Yeah, you need this wide shot.
So we got the best we could get, and that's what we have. But yeah, it was just a thing that fell through the cracks in the production.
Yeah, clearly. Thank you for giving us that little last piece of the jigsaw puzzle on that.
Well, the next shot is in space. We hear another first officer's log from Kira. She says, upon returning to the present with our missing crew members, we were relieved to discover the timeline has been restored. So everything worked out. Yeah. In Sisko's cabin, he's kind of leaning back on a bed or something there, just kind of recovering, and he's very quiet. Bashir comes in and shows Sisko the historical record with Sisko's face is now in the historical record as Gabriel Bell.
I love that moment.
Yeah. Sisko's like, I'm not looking forward to explaining this one to Starfleet Command.
Yeah, that's going to cause some problems down the line for sure.
Yeah.
But the timeline's restored, so.
Yeah, that's what the moment counts, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Sisko, right. Like Kirk, has a long list of temporal violations that eventually gets called out for coming up in a couple seasons.
I will say that when Bashir says, well, at least it's a good picture, and he says, you know, Commander, having seen a little of the 21st century, there is one thing I don't understand. How could they have let things get so bad? And Sisko answers, that's a good question. I wish I had an answer.
It's really a challenge to people.
Yes, yeah. But it was so... time it's so now, you know what I'm saying, in a way
timely.
It was like timely. Yeah. It was so timely. It was like, wow, I can see that being spoken now.
Nothing's really fundamentally changed. Yeah,
go
sad but true.
But it just makes you think, so I just love that you guys included that line of dialogue there.
Great two-parter.
Yeah,
very good. I wrote out a long description of a theme or a lesson. I said, as long as we do the right thing, the best that we can, that progress and solutions will find a way, even if it's not the way we first imagined.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you know, they didn't know how they were going to fix the timeline, or you know, or even how they were going to solve this sanctuary problem. Nobody had a clear answer of how it was going to end, but you just do one step at a time, do the right thing, every little thing will add up. Yeah.
Terry?
I had always fight for the greater good.
Okay.
Great.
Yeah.
Just simple. But yeah.
Robert?
Paradise isn't free.
Yeah.
It takes sacrifice and hard work and small acts of kindness.
Yeah. Random small acts of kindness. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, I think just looking at the overall theme of the dehumanization of people without homes, the people that don't have jobs. And I really feel that the lesson here for me is people are people, the golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated. And that we need to guard against dehumanization, because that is something that happens on a daily basis all around the world. So that's the lesson for me.
Nice.
Our Patreon poll winner for theme moral for this episode is submitted by Alex Ray. Some of the worst problems happen so slowly that we don't notice until it has caused unimaginable harm.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to our recap and discussion of Past Tense Part 2 with our special guest, Robert Hewitt Wolf, who has been absolutely amazing. We've been so happy to
Thank
have
you,
him.
Robert.
Thank you
Thank
so
you,
much.
Robert.
Yeah.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. So for all of our Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material and a little bit more time with the amazing Robert Hewitt Wolf. For everyone else, join us next time when we'll be recapping and discussing the episode Life Support with Armin. So until then, bye.